The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Welcome to Noah Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you, the listener, on your legal rights and resources available. Our goal, to empower you and put you in charge of your case. This is episode 20. I'm your host, attorney Noah Davis, broadcasting live from the studio of Clay 1180 AM in Tacoma, Lakewood, Washington on this beautiful and gorgeous day. Be sure to check out our website at www.noahyourrights.com. There's two R's in there. As we post the audio for each show, as well as follow-up information on each program. You can also email me, many of you do. That email address is noah@noahyourrights.com. Finally, you can visit clay1180.com for more information on me, this show, and other programming on your conversation station. There's been a major legal development coming out this week, as in the case of Murphy, which is the governor of New Jersey, versus the NCAA and alike. There were some major professional associations that joined that lawsuit against the state of New Jersey for passing some legislation regarding sports betting. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down a 1992 federal law, and that's at 28 U.S.C. section 3702, called the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act. And what did that do? Well, that prohibited states from legalizing sports betting. Yeah. But it grandfathered in states like Nevada and three others. So when New Jersey passed legislation to enable sports betting recently, they were sued by the NCAA and some of those major sports leagues to stop them from having that legislation go into effect. So now with the Supreme Court's decision, New Jersey, West Virginia, and there are a few other states are about to dive headfirst into the sports betting arena. What's that going to do to places like Las Vegas, which has almost a monopoly on sports betting and the booking process? I don't know. We'll wait to see. What does it mean for the state of Washington trying to place bets online via an app on your phone? Because with this new federal law, with the federal law being struck down, you're going to see an increase of these online gaming apps come out on your phone, or these companies, and they're going to be based in states like New Jersey, states like West Virginia, which are going to legalize and already have, in some cases, their online sports betting or sports betting regime. So what happens to residents of the state of Washington? Can they use an app from here and bet in a booking place that's in West Virginia? I think the answer right now is no, and be careful, because Washington State currently bans sports gaming betting. It's illegal under state law. We didn't need the federal law, even though there was a 1992 federal law out there that prohibited the states from passing legislation that allowed it. We have a criminal law that prevents sports betting. So be careful until we can figure that out on our side, and the Gambling Commission is going to be updating the legislature about that. So stay tuned. We'll end up having someone from the Gambling Commission come on the show and explain that position and the process and what they think is going to happen. There's a lot of people out there that already think that they can just place bets online on sports betting, and you just cannot do that yet. So got to stay tuned, and we'll get that straightened out for you. So for today, what's going to be our focus? I'm glad you asked. Today's show, we're continuing with our multi-part overview of employment law. Why? Because our jobs are about as important to us as anything. In episodes 17, 18, and 19, those are the last 3 weeks, we've discussed protection against discrimination under federal law, such as the Civil Rights Act of 1964, under Washington state law, the Washington Law Against Discrimination. We also examined retaliation, protection of military members on deployment under USERRA, a federal statute. We covered sexual harassment. And then last week, we spoke with Laura Lindstrom. She's the attorney that works for the State Human Rights Commission. And we went through the claim filing process with the state version of the EOC. Well, today, we're continuing that theme on employment law, and we're going to focus on workers' compensation. What is it? How does it work? And when should you consult an attorney? With me today is local attorney Patrick Paulus. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Patrick, you are a past president of the Washington State Bar. You've been a member of the Plaintiffs Trial Lawyers Association, and you've even had your own TV show called Law Talk, I believe. So it looks like we're going to be in good hands with workers' comp today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I look forward to this.
So I have to admit that this is one area that I'm really a fish out of water. And many of our listeners out there tend to think that as a generalist, I practice in all these different areas of law. And the truth is, while I practice in a lot of different areas of law, there are particular areas that are hands off for me, absolute hands off. And usually for me, that's criminal law, immigration, and another one is absolutely workers' compensation. I had to do a little bit of research before bringing you on and tackling this subject. And I'm going to hand a lot of this off to you today. But I did look up and see that the first workers' compensation law was passed in 1911.
Right.
And that was an effort to provide protection for workers where none existed, you know.
Right.
Going through the Industrial Revolution, it looks like Washington was a leader in workers' compensation type laws. And then we currently have a more modern version, of course, and it's called WSHA. And it's the, not to be confused with the federal workers' compensation law, which is OSHA, or the Occupational Safety Healthy Act. So WSHA was passed. The current version is much more recent, and it seems to be amended from time to time. But we have a very modern version of the workers' compensation law. I know that it's compulsory insurance for employers. Not all states have this, by the way. You know, a lot of the states in the U.S. have this program, a mandatory workers' compensation program, but I don't believe all the states in the U.S. do. Here in Washington, it's compulsory, but there's some exceptions, aren't there? There's some self-employed exceptions. But for the most part, it protects employees and employers from injuries on the job by employees while requiring the employer to meet a number of safety standards. Is that a fair kind of generalist overview of it?
Yeah, I'd say there's two parts here. One is the laws that are for workers to be in a safe work site, right? And those are your WSHA laws, and those are your safety standards. And then there's the Industrial Insurance Act that really is the insurance system that protects injured workers. And that's the one that I work in. I don't find myself ever representing employers who have unsafe job sites, but I always represent the injured worker when they've been hurt.
Well, I'm glad that you said that, because I think I've already started to confuse the two, because WSHA is really the safety part of it, saying
right.
this is what, these are the minimum standards
right.
that the employer must meet.
Yep.
And OSHA, those are the federal law on those similar type standards.
Bingo.
But the industrial insurance, that's the one, and I should say that's the one that I don't believe every state in the U.S. has, the industrial insurance program. I'll double check that to be sure about that. But whether or not every state requires employers to carry insurance to ensure risks of their employees being injured on the job.
Yeah, it looks different state to state. And you mentioned what we did in Washington. And it's true, 1911 is when this act was first created. And the problem was, imagine, if you will, that everybody who was hurt on the job used to have to sue their employer and prove negligence, like in a PI case. And there was hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of injuries, and it became a completely ineffective system. And so the legislature decided that they needed to create a system that was better for everybody. Because if workers didn't have a remedy, you know, the whole economy started to crash. If workers weren't safe from being hurt, the whole economy was hurt. And so they made this this system. And there's a thing there called the Grand Compromise, where injured workers traded in their rights to sue their employer and traded in the requirement for negligence. And in exchange, they were given a system that gave them benefits regardless of fault. Whether they tripped over their own shoes and fell down the stairs, or the employer made stairs that they fell through, it didn't matter. And that was the beginning of the modern system.
And that makes sense, because if you're a small business and you're struggling to make it, particularly, and you're a new business and you have an injured employee and they suffer a serious injury, you might not be able to continue to be a viable business if you didn't have some type of coverage to provide for those injuries. Otherwise, your employee would sue you and put you out of business, potentially, right? So, all right, well, we're talking workers' comp. We have Patrick Paulus with us in studio. We're going to be right back after these messages.
Right now, Cholula, one of America's favorite hot sauces, is teaming up with Jack in the Box for the Cholula Buttery Jack. With Cholula hot sauce, crispy jalapenos, and pepper jack cheese on a signature bun. Try it with Cholula fries. Jack! Can you Cool it with the guitar, please.
Sorry, just got a little excited about the burger.
Try the Cholula Buttery Jack from Jack in the Box. Part of the Buttery Jack family. Limited time only at participating restaurants. Unbelievable.
I'm done.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
You've accidentally cut your daughter's bangs unevenly. Do you A, line things up a centimeter from her hairline?
Man, oh man.
No, sweatbands are so hot right now. Everyone's wearing them, like that basketball player and that other basketball player.
B, get spiritual.
Mom, where did all the mirrors go?
A reflection could never capture our true selves.
Huh?
Beauty is within.
C, look on the bright side.
Less time blow drying, more time texting.
Or D, show empathy.
Mom, you really don't have
to. Twinsies!
I kind of love it. As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Know Your Rights, a show dedicated to providing you information and education on your legal rights and resources available to you. Make sure you visit our website at www.noahyourrights.com. There's two R's in there. Send me an email, noah@noahyourrights.com. We're tackling more of employment law realm this week on today's show. We're also particularly focused on workers' compensation. In studio with me is attorney Patrick Pallas. And he's covering a topic that you're going to find out as you listen to the show that I'm not that familiar with. In fact, during the break, I wanted to make sure that I was given the right information about how many states have this industrial insurance program. And it appears that almost every state now has implemented industrial insurance except for Texas, which makes it voluntary. You know, Texas is always kind of out there, outlier on some of these laws anyway. And so Texas is one of those states that maybe is business friendly. And so they make it a voluntary system. There are a couple other states that have a little bit of a hybrid system or some exemptions, and that's Utah and Vermont. But for the most part, every state has an industrial insurance program in place, and that's the idea is to protect both the employer and the employee from lawsuits relating to accidents on the job, right?
Well, and let me add to that, because I mean that's a piece of it. But I think the benefit of the industrial insurance system is that we have people that are healthy, and if they do get hurt, they get the basic medical care they need, they get the basic wages they need, and help to return back to work absolutely as soon as possible. That's what's best for the employer, that's what's best for the employee. It's really holistic, and you said something a minute ago about Texas maybe being business friendly. I want to suggest to you here that in Washington, that this is a system that is really good for employers and really good for injured workers, because the system really works to get people back into their jobs and gives them the benefits they're fully entitled to. And at the same time, employers don't pay some of the ridiculous costs that could be leveraged in a system that wasn't managed well and isn't a fair or good system. Washington really, and I'll tell you what, there's people who will push back, particularly people who get stuck in the system. But when you look at the systems across this country, the system in Washington, the way our government's put it together, the way our legislature built this, with the stakeholders all being at the table to build it, have built a very good system. Yeah, it's got some problems. It's got some real problems. But compared to other states, this is the best place to get injured as an employer or as an employee.
Well, every rose has its thorns, right? Every rose. But this system gives consistency, doesn't it? It gives you a sense of surety. You know that if you're injured on the job, there's going to be a system of insurance that compensates you, that ends up providing doctors or healthcare, pays your medical bills, provides you some compensation, right. as you said, returns you to work. So there's consistency in the system. If it wasn't present, what would happen is you'd end up having, if your employer didn't voluntarily pay you, you'd have to file a lawsuit, and that could take a year or longer for that, for something like that to resolve, right?
Yeah, that old-fashioned system pre-1911,
yeah,
not workable.
Not workable. That's right. Well, so you talked about this being a no-fault system in Washington, and that's great. So it doesn't matter if the employee was the one that stabbed themselves in the eye or cut off their finger. They're going to be eligible for some compensation as part of this industrial insurance program. And the employer pays into this by hour, by employee, this industrial insurance rate. And it really doesn't cost that much. I mean, I guess if it's an unsafe industry, they might have higher premiums. But for ours, for example, law firms, it doesn't seem to be that much, the insurance premium rate. So it's like a fair system from a financial standpoint, it would appear.
It's built on rewards for employers that have lower rates of injury. And if you're one of those employers that's a frequent flyer, that you leave your employees open to get injured or have a really dangerous place and you have a lot of injured folks, your rates are going up. I mean, it's kind of like your car insurance. If you get in car accidents every week, don't be surprised that your rates go up, right? That's the way the system is worked. It works here. And so, you know, most office jobs have pretty low rates for L&I. And it's only the ones that are the most dangerous jobs, like people who do green chain, right? Working in the lumber industry, timber faller.
Or scaffolding on the tall buildings, right. Or something like that.
They pay higher rates.
Yeah. So what happens when someone is injured on the job? If you can take us through like that process a little bit. Who do they report to? Do they call the federal government, the state government? What's the first step?
Yeah. So understand that any one of these questions that I'm sure you're going to ask about the system is like a seminar in itself.
Right,
I'm going to give
right.
you really just the bare bones here because I don't know that everybody listening needs the full consultation.
Fair enough.
So understand, maybe your listeners understand that this is really the short version. This is just the highlights, and which is this. In this state, if someone is injured, you have an obligation as an injured worker to file a claim, and your employer also has the exact same obligation. You must file a claim. And I know that guys sometimes like, dude, I don't want to wreck our pizza party coming up because I injured myself, so I'm just not going to say anything. I don't want the boss pissed off, right?
Right.
But it comes back to bite you because maybe that injury is serious and maybe a year from now you need surgery and you've just waived all your rights and suddenly you can't get surgery, you can't get care, you don't have wage loss benefits, and your employer says, I got to fire you. You know, you're no good to me here. You're not coming into work. So everyone needs to file a claim. It's very easy. Your doctor can do it for you. You can get a claim form from the Department of Labor and Industries. But you file your claim, you fill it out, you give all the information you need, and you're off and running.
So it sounds like there's a time limit. From the point that you're injured, there's going to be it starts ticking. The time starts ticking.
It does. You have a year if it's a traumatic injury. You have 2 years if it's occupational disease, which means some repetitive trauma like
carpal tunnel
or hearing loss, those kind of things.
All right, and you said that your doctor can make that report for you. So is that something when you go to the clinic and you said, yeah, I hurt my elbow at work, right away the doctor's already. They're already attuned to that, so they have the forms in place.
Yeah, they fill out part of the form. You fill out part of the form. The process really is often begun at the doctor's office.
Do you find cases, or are you aware of cases when the employee does go back to the employer and the employer goes, ah, John, you got hurt again. I can't believe this. This pizza party's going to be off, and I'm making an announcement. So they're treated a little bit harshly, you know, for maybe making that claim. Have you seen that sort of thing?
You see a full range. You know, there are employers who I think are very holistic in their thinking and understand that that taking care of the worker means they're taking care of their business and everyone is there to work together and those systems work well. You find other employers that are very punitive, like you get hurt, we're coming after you. And by law, they can't take any action for filing a claim. But you do see people taking action against workers. And, you know, that's where lawyers like me step up to balance out playing field.
And the employer would try to hide it, you know, wouldn't say, well, we're not retaliating against you for filing the claim. You've been late a bunch of times this week, and so that's why we're treating you differently. That's why we put you out in the garage.
You know, despite the common perception, I don't see injured workers faking claims or manipulating facts. This system is so ratcheted down now. It's so ratcheted down that people who have severe, significant injuries sometimes have trouble getting benefits. But by the same token, people have horror stories about employers. By and large, I see employers acting fairly. We may have reasonable disagreements about how the law is applied, and we may have, you know, battles that way. But I think most employers act fairly and act adequately under the law. There's only a few frequent flyer abusers out there, and those are the ones that I see most often.
So when some clients have come to me in the past and like, no, I got injured at work. Can you handle this claim? And I'll peel open the law and industrial insurance, workers' comp, and I'll see that there's a permanent partial disability, total disability, all this language. And I'm totally
What is all that mess?
Yeah, I'm totally unfamiliar with all that, and I don't know what to make of it. And so I tend to stay away and send them to professionals like you. But can you explain a little bit about the claim process? I mean, I imagine that you start off at the doctor. Like, you're probably not going to get paid on a claim if you're injured at work unless you've seen a doctor to start with, right?
Yeah, you know, we call this the alphabet soup of L&I, because it seems like everything that happens in L&I has a couple of letters attached to it, and workers get lost. And I might add also that the whole Industrial Insurance Act, there's 350 different statutes, and then you have all the case law that goes on top of it. I mean, no, really, this is smart that you stayed out of this area of law, right? It's an area where you really have to learn it and know it, which is why it's challenging for injured workers to come in and just think they're going to navigate this system effortlessly and start and just follow it and trust the state does the right thing or trust their employer does the right thing. You know, I'll walk through the system with you, but the bottom line is it pays to know your rights. It pays to know your remedies. You know, you can call a lawyer. You can get free information. Free, did I say free? Free? Free information from any lawyer you want to call, or go to websites and collect information. Our website has a huge resource page. It has on it a thing we called the PatBot. I don't know where it got that name, that PatBot, but and it's a free case analysis, and then it gives you a toolbox. So it tells you exactly what to do in your case. It walks you through the whole process. It's free. It's 24/7. We also have a thing on our website called the PPD, Permanent Partial Disability Calculator. So for those people who want to know what their case is worth, and how often do you hear that, right? Do I have a case? What's my case worth?
Yeah, all the time. I think that should be one of the first questions, yeah.
So we set up a calculator right there on the homepage of our website that's a calculator, and you can put in answer three questions, and we'll tell you to the dollar what your case is worth.
What's the address of that website?
Yeah, it's palacelaw.com, PalaceLaw.com.
When clients start calling me about their cases, I might end up going to your website and use a calculator so I could tell them. Well, so do people need to get lawyers involved at the beginning? Because if you're filling out this application for benefits, whether you're at the doctor's office, you're in the employer's office, or you're doing it online, because I think you could do these online with L&I now, what you put on those initial applications can really stay with you throughout the claim, right? So isn't it important to get it right?
Yeah, I tell people all the time, you know, don't wait until your case has gone to hell, right? Till you're being cut off or the claim's been denied or you've been seen by three of the state or the employer's doctors hired to say that you're not particularly hurt or you're not hurt at all, right? You need to be proactive. And I really like people to find out as much as they can. Front load your brain full of knowledge about workers' comp and then head into the system. Don't navigate it blindly, hoping it's going to work out just fine. And then when things go wrong, surprised that it didn't go your way. So yeah, know everything you can. Call an attorney, get some free advice. Doesn't mean you have to retain me or anybody else. We're not going to charge you for it. But I'll tell you what, I would much rather give advice to somebody and keep their case clean and head in the right direction than have them call me a year down the road, having lost everything, including their house, their car, and their wife, and then say, can you unring all the bells here? Can you put all the bad evidence away and make this thing, can I have a redo? And the answer often is
no,
maybe, but no, you know?
Right. And does the employer, if you're injured at, like, let's say it's at my law office and an employee's injured doing something, I guess, typing, and they came in. I mean, do employers try to mitigate the case at that point by trying to get information to, if they're the ones that are the first source of input for the employee, do you see that, the employer trying to tone down the injury or what happened?
I don't, but I think that there's a certain amount of room in there for disagreement as to how an injury happened and where it happened and who you reported it to and those kind of things. And I think employers look out for themselves and employees look out for themselves. And oftentimes there's maybe some truth on both sides, but it depends. It depends on the case and it depends on the employer.
You're listening to Know Your Rights on Clay, 1180 AM.
Hi, I'm Jack Box, and for the millions of Americans living with a taco obsession, my new $3 taco deal with three of the tacos you love and a small drink can offer relief. Relief for people like Janet, who changed her name to Mrs. Taco.
Actually, it's Ms. Taco.
Or Dave, who celebrates Taco Tuesday every day.
Taco Tuesday!
No, Dave, it's Sunday, and it's your wife's birthday.
Oh, I should get her some tacos!
So please, try my $3 taco deal today. New at Jack in the Box. Limited time only. Price and participation may vary. Small fountain drink.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Dave, what are you doing?
Just sending a gift to Dave 2037.
Who?
Me in the future. I save a little money from every paycheck as a gift to Dave 2037, so he can spend it on things like anti-gravity boots or a hologram Doberman. Something cool like that. I think Dave 2037 deserves it. He worked hard. What are you getting Steve 2037?
I guess I was thinking Steve 2037 would just fend for himself.
Well, all right. But don't expect to be borrowing my anti-gravity boots.
You want to have money in your future? You got to start saving now. Putting some money from every paycheck into a savings account or contributing to your 401k can make a big difference later. Put away a few bucks, feel like $1 million. For free ideas and easy ways to save, go to feedthepig.org. That's
feedthepig.org.
Hey, let's just hope Steve 2037 doesn't get his hands on a cold time machine, because he is going to come back here and knock some sense into you.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Know Your Rights, the show dedicated to educating you on your legal rights and resources available to you. The only show that's dedicated as such on Clay 1180 AM, your conversation station. We are live broadcasting out of Lakewood, Tacoma, Washington, as we always do. It's a beautiful day. In studio with me is attorney Patrick Pallas. We're talking employment law, but particularly we're talking workers' compensation, area that I normally don't practice in, but that obviously is so important to us as employees and as employers, and making sure that we understand that system. Just before the break, we were talking about the process of filing a claim. We're talking about the language, partial, permanent disability. We talked about Patrick's website and your ability to go visit that and get information and use some of the free resources they have there. You know, Patrick, I want to talk a little bit about the process of doctors in this because they seem to be such an integral part of this. I mean, right. You might have an injury that's clear because your finger was cut off, right? But then the question is, how does that affect your ability to do the job? And then people put different percentages on that. And I can't feign to understand the percentages or how any of that works. But there are also going to be situations where someone has a knee injury or an elbow injury. And the question is, was it pre-existing? Was it job related? And then how is that going to impact them now and on into the future? So I know I just hit you with a lot, but can you start to make some sense of that and how the doctors play into this? Can I just go see my family practitioner? What doctor do I need to start with in this process? And are there other doctors involved? Like, does the state get a doctor? Does the employer get a doctor? Like, who are the players in this?
Well, let me start backwards, or maybe where you started, and work my way up there. There's a couple of places that injured workers tend to fall into and not realize, you know, how did I get here? And one of those places is this question of causation, right? It's a requirement that your injury was caused, at least in part, by your job. And that can be a big debate when we're talking about, and I'm going to say it, pre-existing injuries, right? It's one of those words that makes so many injured workers cringe. The Department of Labor and Industries and self-insured employers like to use the idea of pre-existing injuries as a way to deny claims, to limit benefits. And we joke about this some in our office. In fact, I did a little video with Ryan Castle from KISW, and we kind of made fun of this, right? Because it didn't matter what you say, your injury is like, I fell off a ladder, I hurt my knee. The department's response is, pre-existing, right? The reality is that for injured workers, you may have lots of pre-existing injuries. It's hard to go through life without having some scars, some bumps, some surgeries, right? But that doesn't mean that anytime you re-injure that part of your body, that it's excluded forever. If the industrial injury had some effect on that body part, then you have a legitimate claim, and you shouldn't allow the state or the Department of Labor Industries to buffalo you into denying an entire condition. And that's one of those big holes that people fall into and don't understand how they got there.
And that sounds a lot like the plaintiff's injury, personal injury case law that's developed about you find your victim or you take your victim as you find them. And right. So if you have an eggshell driver and they're hit from behind at 5 miles an hour, but that lights up pre-existing injuries, you're still responsible for that. It doesn't matter if they were pre-existing or not, because it was the accident that caused them to reignite.
You know, the common scenario for that is that, you know, people do get more vulnerable as they get older. I mean, a 70-year-old person is going to get hurt probably with less trauma and have a more significant injury than somebody who's 22 years old and crazy fit, right? So when somebody does have an injury, even when it's minor, and they have a really vulnerable condition, then you're going to have an injury, and that's part of the claim system. But a lot of people, boy, they wait too long and they don't understand that process, and the doctors may not be clear about whether it's pre-existing or aggravated or all caused, and it gets to be tough. It's places where people need advice and need some help navigating.
So on the doctor's front, again, if I see these U.S. health work type places around, and sure. It seems like those are industrial insurance based kind of, and they're always, not always, but they seem to be located near, like, for example, the Port of Tacoma, places where there's going to be maybe a high incidence of worker injury. And is that like the first stop for a lot of people that are injured in an accident, go to a place called like U.S. Health Works?
It is. I mean, there are clinics that are occupational health clinics, right, that are geared towards people who are injured on the job, or, you know, they may also do the P test, those kind of things as part of their drug test, as part of their process. But injured workers should know this. I mean, your listeners should know that if you're injured on the job, you can go to any doctor you want to go to, right? Too often they think they have to go to the employer's doctor or this is a requirement for them. And I'm here to tell you, you go to anybody you want to go to. It is your choice. And you shouldn't be buffaloed into going to somebody of your employer's choice, because that's not the way the LNI system works.
And the employer is probably saying, hey, here's a note and the address. Dr. Bob's expecting you. Go see him. And that's probably like a lot of employers probably do that. They probably have a go-to doctor that treats people and returns them. I'm not saying that all employers are bad or all employers do that, but I bet you there's a system in place that kind of does that.
Especially the big employers. They have a doctor's office or clinic that does all of their drug testing, they have a relationship with, that does all of their physicals, right? And that's fine. I mean, that's a great relationship, and I'm perfectly happy about that relationship with employers. But injured workers understand that they don't have to go see that doctor. In fact, I'm going to suggest that they don't. Now, frankly, there are some really good occupational clinics out there that I would gladly send any of my family to. But if you don't know a good clinic from a clinic that may be a biased clinic or a biased doctor, then play it safe. Go to the doctor you know, your family doctor, someone you trust, someone you like, someone's going to take care of you.
And those are the doctors that say, oh, it's just a flesh wound. I think that's from the European vacation, the guy on the bicycle gushing out blood. But, okay, well, let's get back to this regime of workers' comp and industrial insurance. So when a claim form is filled out and the, I guess, LNI ends up doing a review of the case, what type of findings are entered, or what does that look like when a claim is accepted by LNI? And can you talk to us a little bit about that?
I guess. Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the system for our purposes is pretty simple, that there's medical records that are reviewed by a claims manager who then decides whether it meets the criteria for a claim and the claim's accepted. Then the ongoing care is frequently dictated by the doctor in a treatment plan that comes in the doctor's notes, and you head down that road. And most people get down the road just fine for a while until the conditions are complicated or there's additional conditions that are there. People often will hurt their right shoulder and not realize their back was injured until a couple days later, and the right shoulder gets better, and then you have a right shoulder and a back, and things can sometimes migrate and grow as you try to recover and things start to show up. Can cause problems.
And you overcompensate. You end up, if your right shoulder hurts, you end up using your left shoulder, or you use your left hip or whatever, and you end up hurting something else because you're walking in a different way, or you're using your body in a way it's not meant to be used.
We rely a lot on the really good work of attending doctors who know their patients and know that the condition was there before or wasn't, or how it's been aggravated, or trust their patients. But there's this, I'm going to say balance, and maybe that's an unfair word, but for the good attending doctors who know their patients, take care of them, the Department of Labor Industries and self-insured employers say, hey, we get to have some checks and balances. We get to use our own doctors. And then they send the injured worker to their doctor. Now, I would say that was just fine in the big scheme of things, all things being equal. But I have a particular bias. Understand, it's because I represent injured workers. And I cross-examine these so-called independent medical doctors on the stand, and I don't trust them, and I don't trust this system. They're not there to look out for the best interest of the injured worker. They're there as a cost-saving mechanism, and the doctors that get hired in those roles work that role very well to save money. They are the naysayers, the you're not hurt, you know, it'll grow back later, guys.
Yeah, and when you end up deposing them or you have them on trial, you learn that a lot of their professional business is from these industrial cases. They might be making hundreds of thousands of dollars from the employer or from a group of employers to mitigate or deny these types of claims. Like, it's just repeat business for them. And if they start saying, oh, all your employees are injured, they're gonna be out of a job. They're gonna be out of the income. So there's that conflict of interest too.
Yeah, it's a very challenging part of the system for me. And I'm not saying all IMEs, we call them insurance medical examiners or defense medical examiners, that all of them are unfair. There are some very good ones out there, and I appreciate their integrity. But the system is geared against injured workers. When you go to an IME, workers need to understand, that's not a good idea. That's not good for you. You're probably going to take some hits from that exam. They're going to bring up evidence against you. Their job is to close your case, to limit your benefits, to stop payments, to save the department, and to save the employer money. And if injured workers walk into those exams thinking that there's somebody who's going to give them an independent opinion, it's a rude awakening when they see what happens in a five-minute exam with a biased doctor hired by the employer that's trying to save money on your back.
Right. And so then this independent, it's not really independent, it's a defense medical exam, if you want to call it that, that report ends up going to the state. And so now this examiner re-looks at, so there's been like a protest on the findings from the that were initially made maybe in the case. There's this defense exam that takes place with the employer's doctor, who finds in favor of the employer and more or less saying that, oh, this injury isn't an 80% permanent disability. It's more like 5% permanent disability and like 15% partial.
Right. It gets to be a battle of the medical opinions, right? The opinions that are paid for by the Department of Labor and Industries by their doctors versus the opinions of the attending treating doctors. And that can be very frustrating because the department and self-insured employers can hire repeat IMEs. One after the other after the other, and stack opinions a mile high, and then say, look, we've got to be right because we have 3, 4, 5 of our doctors we paid to say there was nothing wrong, and you only have your attending doctor, so therefore we win. The good news is that strategy doesn't work in the light of day. When you get into litigation or cross-examination, you expose those doctors' opinions for what they are, which is a scam on the system.
We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Know Your Rights on Clay 1180 AM.
Right now, Cholula, one of America's favorite hot sauces, is teaming up with Jack in the Box for the Cholula Buttery Jack. With Cholula hot sauce, crispy jalapenos, and pepper jack cheese on a signature bun. Try it with Cholula fries. Jack! Can you cool it with the guitar, please?
Sorry, just got a little excited about the burger.
Try the Cholula Buttery Jack from Jack in the Box. Part of the Buttery Jack family. Limited time only at participating restaurants. Unbelievable.
I'm done.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Over there, over there's the water. Whoosh, whoosh. And look at all this stuff I'm standing on. It's called sand, and it's everywhere.
This woman may sound silly to you and me.
It's made up of little tiny pieces of rocks. Teeny little pieces of rocks.
But to her 2-year-old son exploring the world around him, she makes perfect sense.
How does it feel when you touch the sand? Is it warm?
Uh-huh.
It's hard to hold in your hand, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Learning starts long before school does, and children are naturally curious. They want to learn, so follow their lead. Take simple, everyday moments, like sorting laundry or playing on the beach, and turn them into learning moments.
Is this water?
No.
Very good. This is sand. Oh, no, it's not food. It's sand. We don't eat sand.
Turn everyday moments into learning moments. Find out how at bornlearning.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Noah Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. We're talking employment law. Make sure that you go to our website, noahyourrights.com. You'll end up finding the audio from today's show, from past show, and also additional resources that can be available to you. I'll make sure that for today's show, I'll put on both Patrick Paulus's website, where he talked about the resources that you could go and you can click on that can help evaluate your case and also give you some information about what you need to do to be successful in your case. I'll also put some information for L&I on there as well, so that you can have some background information. But Patrick Paulus's website is going to be a great, great resource for you, and you're going to be able to find that through the NoahYourRights.com site as well. So we're talking with Patrick Paulus. We're talking employment law. We're talking particularly industrial insurance and workers' compensation. Patrick, I wanted to, in this last segment that we have today, I want to talk about the process for appeals. So let's say that the worker is injured, they file their claim, we talked about that, they saw some doctors, maybe there's competing doctors, but L&I ends up putting something down on paper saying that this is the injury the person has and this is what they're entitled to. Somebody protests that, somebody disagrees with that, whether it's the employee or it's the employer. What's the process next?
You can go through several layers of disagreement, right? Protests and reconsiderations that are all administrative. At the end of that process, there's a final order that's issued. And the final order is either for you or against you. And then either party can appeal. And that appeal goes to what's called the Board of Industrial Insurance Appeals. It's a judicial branch. It's a completely separate and independent branch from the Department of Labor Industries and from employers. And they have the jurisdiction then to decide whatever issue is brought before them. And they do it most often by way of trial. But there's a laundry list of ways, like mediation, that you can work through. You can settle it on your own. You can try it with or without a lawyer. And that next step outside of the Department of Labor Industries is one of those really challenging places for injured workers to be.
And are those administrative law judges that hear those cases?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, that's exactly right.
All right. And if so you have this sort of mini trial before, do you present evidence and appear and have kind of a trial at the Board of Industrial Appeals, or is it just more like a traditional appeal where you...
No, they are real trials.
Okay.
Just like you would see on TV or in Superior Court. The only difference is that there's no jury. They're all what we call bench trials, where we try the case in front of the judge, but you bring up witnesses, they're sworn under oath, direct and cross-examination, each party brings their witnesses, motions that go throughout the process, trial briefs, everything. It's a full trial.
And if you, depending on the decision there, what happens next? Do you have an appeal from the Board of Industrial Appeals?
Oh my gosh, yeah. The life that industrial insurance claims have for both employers and employees is something. Yeah. If you're curious, so you go through the administrative system, and then maybe you end up, because the employer appeals or the injured worker appeals, then you go through the Board of Industrial Insurance Appeals and have your trial. The judge makes a determination. Well, somebody's not happy. Somebody then asks for a review, and you go through the appellate portion of the Board of Industrial Insurance Appeals, and that decision is decided. Somebody's unhappy. You can appeal it to Superior Court, where you do actually have a jury trial, and then the jury then decides the outcome of the case, and then maybe somebody's not happy with that. You can appeal to the Court of Appeals, and then you have a three-panel set of judges listen to it, and then the outcome is there. And then what if someone doesn't like that? You can ask to go to the Supreme Court and have your case at the Supreme Court. We had a case in the Supreme Court last year and was very happy to say that we won. We have another case at the Supreme Court this year. They take some time to get there, and there's a lot of room from beginning of a case to an end sometimes.
Well, I mean, it could be years. I mean, it could be 3 or 4 years.
It really can be.
And during that, if you're sort of on the losing, through the process, the losing side, and so you're the ones that push the appeal through, your client might not be getting benefits this entire time, potentially depending on what the situation is.
It depends who's appealing, right? If we're winning the case, we're getting benefits all the way through, and the employer is appealing. If the opposite happens, that it's been a denial of benefits, then right, the injured worker has to suffer all the way along to prove that he or she is entitled to benefits.
If you won all the way and it got reversed in the Supreme Court of Washington, is it possible that your client would ever have to repay benefits that they received?
Theoretically, that can happen. Most often, it's a denial of benefits, and then the Supreme Court or Court of Appeals or Superior Court or somewhere turns them back on. And then injured workers are entitled to all their back benefits.
It would be a pretty harsh penalty to say, oh, you've received these benefits the last 4 years, now you got to pay them back. I can't imagine that sort of scenario playing itself out, huh?
It can happen. Injured workers do have to be careful that can happen. But, boy, I hope that they're getting legal advice long before then so they don't get caught.
Well, I want to talk about two in the last 5 or 6 minutes that we have. I want to talk about two different areas that we maybe have touched on but not gone into any depth. One is, what happens if you're a small business, like you're a truck loader and you're a two-person business, you're the owner and employee hurts their back loading trucks, and now they're out that employee. What's this light duty requirement, and what if they can't hire them back because the job is to load trucks? I mean, what do you can you fire them, can you replace them? Does it get a little tricky?
That really does get tricky. I mean, I think that the intent of the system is that you try to get everybody back to work as soon as they can. If they can't go back to the old job they had and they have some limitations, and the doctor gives them light duty and they go back to light duty until they can return to work. And that's the intent. Obviously, it can get messy sometimes if people pick up new injuries when they're already injured, or if the employer gives them work that's too hard, or the doctor was wrong about the limitations. I mean, there's a lot of things. It's just a case-by-case basis situation.
Well, what happens in a situation where, like, let's say it's a construction worker and they're on a construction site and they work for a subcontractor, and they're on the scaffolding, but the scaffolding wasn't built by their boss, by their employer. It was built by the general or another subcontractor. And you end up falling. There's somebody was negligent maybe, or the employee just fell off and they're injured. What happens in a scenario like that? Who do you sue when there are other parties besides your employer involved?
So sometimes people have more than one claim. They have the workers' compensation claim, and yet they still have a personal injury claim against somebody who's not their employer, and they have two claims. People don't always know that they have two possible claims when you're injured by somebody who's not your co-employee or your employer. And all too often, they miss that. And they literally waive all of their rights by not understanding that they have a second claim. For those people who do understand it, it's a situation where you get all the benefits under your Workers' Compensation Act, and you may be entitled to all the benefits in a personal injury case. And those people they need to know that, and they need to protect themselves and their families and exercise their rights to the benefits they'd be entitled to.
Well, that sounds like another reason to talk to a lawyer. I mean, you have this the application process, which could end up staying with you through the entire claim. You have these potential defense exams, which can be very precarious for you. You might have these industrial appeals. And then now you're talking about potential, in some cases, third-party liability. It sounds complicated. Right. I'm a lawyer, and I don't want to do any of this, you know, because it's like beyond my pay grade. I would want to see a lawyer that does workers' comp.
I will tell you, it's the reason why in the 25 years that I've practiced workers' compensation law, we have set up a number of systems so that we're able to give free advice, free access, free information, and resources, because there are far more people that need the help than I'm physically able to represent. So in our website, I mentioned this earlier, we have the thing called the PatBot, where you can put in some facts about your case and analyze your case for you, and then tells you how to do it yourself. We have what I call our PPD calculator, our settlement calculator, that tells you the value of your case, because you may not know that. It's a way to keep the Department of Labor Industries honest, because we'll tell you what the value of your case is. There's resources there, and the internet, fortunately, is also full of resources. And I can't emphasize enough that you really do need to be proactive and to take care of yourself and to know your rights and know your remedies. And I'm glad you have this show, because not just for workers' comp, but because people need to understand what their rights and remedies are. If it wasn't for guys like you stepping up and helping push that information out, a lot more people would waive their rights and lose their opportunities to be taken advantage of. And I'm glad you have a show like this to do that.
Well, I appreciate that very much. And I think our listeners do as well, and that we're sort of taking up this torch and spreading the word. Now, when people do workers' comp claims, do they have to pay their lawyer hourly? How does that compensation system work?
You know, thanks for asking that, because I think most people are so scared of a lawyer. Like, I don't want to get a lawyer, dude. They're so expensive. I can't afford that. In workers' compensation, we don't charge by the hour. You don't give workers' compensation attorneys retainers. It's based on a contingency fee, which means if we're successful at the end of your case, then we get paid. And look, it has to be that way, because if you had to pay me by the hour and you have these huge medical bills and you're not working, guess what? You've just lost your rights. You have no way to get a remedy. You've lost your keys to the courthouse. Your access to justice is simply waived. It's not fair to make an injured worker who's already up against huge amounts of financial loss and in pain and needing surgery to have to pay a lawyer just to get basic services. So what we do is we do it on a contingency fee. And if we win your case at the very end, if we get you the benefits you're entitled to, then our fee is it depends but on the case, but it's generally it's 30% of your final disability award at the end of the case. And you know what? If we work hard and we push your case all the way through at the end, you don't get a disability award, then we're the hardest working free attorneys in town, and I'm proud to be that.
Hey, Patrick, besides being a lawyer and sharing that background, the legal background that we have, I think we share something else, and that's we're both fans of very nice, beautiful wine, but you've taken it one step farther. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I decided 3 years ago that I wanted to start a winery. I loved wine. I have worked in restaurants and in the business, but I never made wine. So we started Sunken Cellars, and so we make a white wine, we make Cabernet, we make a red blend. In fact, we after 2 years in new French oak, we just released our very first set of red wines that are available right now. SunkenCellars.com, shameless plug, there it is.
That's
but
great.
You're right, I'm a wine fan and a little bit of a wine geek. And even though it's
I love it.
It's very fun to do. It really has been a passion of mine to do. So thank you for asking about that, Noah. You're a good man.
Yeah, and Patrick, thank you so much for joining Noah Your Rights on this episode, joining us and talking to us about workers' compensation. So appreciate having you on the show.
You're doing good work, Noah. Thank you for stepping up and doing this. We all appreciate it.
And all you listeners out there, thanks for spending the last hour with us on Noah Your Rights. Thanks for supporting Clay 1180 AM. I hope you tune in next week, same time, same day. We'll see you then.